Warning. The opinions expressed on this radio show are not approved by any of the usual sponsoring authorities. Please help this show remain non-commercial and subversive. Go to truthjihad.com and subscribe or offer a one-time donation. Thank you, and God bless. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, looking for the truth and trying to stand up for justice and bringing on the voices of people who are on board with that. One of them is my guest today, Dr. Samuel Arian. He's well known as having gone from being America's most effective Muslim political organizer within the Democratic Republican electoral framework to being a prisoner of conscience, indeed practically a martyr to the Zionist domination of the United States of America. Spent many years in prison for the crime of opposing Zionism and standing for justice, and is now in Turkey. He just wrote a terrific brief piece outlining the concrete steps that should be taken by the world Muslim community and the Muslim countries to react to Trump's announcement recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and threatening to move, or promising to move, the U.S. embassy there. So, hey, welcome, Dr. Samuel Arian. Salaamu Alaikum. Good to be with you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so now this is a very strange situation that we're in right now. In some ways, not an entirely unpropitious one, with a very, very unpopular and some think somewhat insane or unstable American president pushing this Zionist takeover of Jerusalem. And the world is not really on board with it. But as you point out, the Muslim world hasn't yet really stood up and taken any concrete steps to stop it.
Well, actually, it hasn't. You know, it's very distressing for many people that no one has cut relations, either with Israel or maybe suspended diplomatic relations with the U.S. No one is suspended any kind of trade deal or arms sales or you know, we've only seen some symbolic things like protests throughout. So I think what we need is people's strategy, because the governments themselves have not been very effective, with one exception, of course. Turkey has been trying to do something, but they haven't been given any kind of support from others. So they went for this symbolic, I guess, but it will have much significance once it gets recognized by many people, or many countries rather, around the world, which is to recognize Jerusalem, or East Jerusalem, as they say, as the capital of the state of Palestine.
And what is the current status of Turkey's relationship or non-relationship with Israel? Because somebody emailed me and said that Turkey should change the name on its current embassy or consulate or what have you in Israel, Palestine. Does Turkey have relations, official relations with Israel now?
Unfortunately, they do. They restored their relations earlier this year. They also have a consulate in Jerusalem, and what they announced is that their consulate in Jerusalem would be renamed as an embassy, in which the Israeli government was furious about that. So low degree warfare, or at least lots of tension. If you noticed yesterday, the Israeli representative to the UN, when he made his statement, obviously was the most arrogant statement I've ever heard. You know, went back to biblical stuff, which is you know, a different story. It wasn't really a political statement at all, but it was implicit in a huge attack on Turkey and its leader.
It's interesting that Turkey has emerged as a strong voice now, because, as you say, Turkey has had various kinds of official and unofficial relations with Israel down through the years. It's a member of NATO, and today, suddenly, we're witnessing a certain degree of independence in Turkey. And now, Turkey used to be the center, kind of much of the Muslim Ummah under the Ottoman Empire. So do you think this was something that maybe Trump and Netanyahu miscalculated when they made this move?
I think when it comes to the U.S. and Israel, what they care about is not rhetoric. And what we have seen so far is basically rhetoric, some of it very hot rhetoric. So until these kind of things become real actions, we've witnessed, you know, throughout the history, before Oslo, after Oslo, is that the only thing Israel understands, and the UN, and the U.S. rather, is really a language where there is a cost to the decisions they make. And so far, there hasn't been much cost.
In fact, on the contrary, right now Israel is becoming the closest friend of the Gulf sheikhdoms and dictatorships as those countries pursue increasingly insane policies, destabilizing countries, destroying Yemen, and so on. And the Israelis are about ready to practically merge with the Saudis and some of the other Gulf potentates. So this strikes me as a really serious issue, since, you know, we're talking about the country with custodianship of the holy places in Mecca and Medina, teaming up with the worst of the Zionists. So that seems to me to be the chief stumbling block right now. What possibly could be done? Is there a way that we can somehow encourage regime change in Riyadh?
Good question. But, you know, obviously what is emerging now is an alliance between Israel and some Arab states, chiefly among them Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Egypt, and until recently Jordan. And of course, Jordan is an exception, and I will discuss why the King of Jordan has really turned sharply against what's happening by the UN and Israel. But the U.S. has always been a blind supporter of Israel. 43 vetoes have been cast since 1973, 35 of them by Republican presidents, 8 by Democratic presidents. Every single president since Nixon has used a veto for the benefit of Israel to justify its occupation, its bombardment of civilians, of killing of children, of preventing the UN from doing its job by helping Palestinians in supporting settlements, all these things that happened, you know, throughout the past 44 years or so, the U.S. has been part and parcel of this, and with absolutely no cost, with impunity. So people now are trying to figure out what needs to be done. But even with that, all previous presidents since Clinton have refused to recognize Jerusalem, because they knew that this is a very volatile issue, and needlessly it will start a cycle of violence and hatred and animosity towards the UN and Israel. However, we have a president now that he thinks he can get away with it, and the Arabs are at their weakest point, because now they look at Iran as being a bigger threat than any other threat in the area, and they are willing to ally themselves with Satan in order to face up to that challenge, which I think they are, especially Saudi Arabia, is losing on all fronts. It's lost in Syria, it's lost in Yemen, it's lost in Iraq. Everywhere you go, they tried a stunt in Lebanon, it failed. They tried to blockade Qatar, it failed. It's failure everywhere.
Right, and that leads to the question of how I can understand why the Ibn Saud dynasty would see Iran as a threat, because Iran represents an Islamic revolution, which is a model that Khomeini and others wanted to present to the rest of the Muslim countries in the region, a model of overthrowing the Western puppets, such as the Ibn Saud family and the other puppets that rule the region. So certainly Iran is a threat to those individuals, but how in the world is it a threat to the ordinary people of these countries, who would be vastly better off if they could follow the same model that Iran did and win freedom from the empire?
Of course, there's a huge problem in the Middle East. It's a huge fault line that exists for centuries, and the U.S. and other outside forces are trying to exploit it, primarily the U.S. and Israel, which is sectarianism. And what happens is that people don't see beyond their identity this feeling that they are being threatened by Shiism and so on and so forth, without looking at the bigger danger. You know, as I said earlier, Saudi Arabia, since 1980, they were trying to confront this threat. Of course, it's not a religious threat in any way. It's a threat because the lifestyle that Saudis have chosen and their political system was threatened by a popular revolution that was basically trying to respond to the people. And in Saudi Arabia, that is not the political system. So they built this Gulf cooperation. It was really based, the Saudi security system was based on four things. And what happened is that the current regime, the current crown prince, has basically destroyed all four. The first was the harmony within the family, the royal family. You know, they had a line of succession that went from one son to the next, and then when they were supposed to get to the next generation, they were supposed to find some kind of a consensus. This guy came out of nowhere. He imprisoned, you know, exiled, arrested, whatever he wanted to do with the others so that he can get all the power in his hands. The second pillar was American protection. Since Roosevelt, it was a tacit understanding they will get American protection in return for oil and making sure that oil will be sold in dollars and will never be switched to any other currency. When Trump came, basically he changed that calculation. Now it's based on financial obligations from Saudi Arabia to pay the U.S. $100 billion with no loyalty, nothing in return. And incidentally, I would, you know, the guarantee that King Abdullah of Jordan was given by successive presidents to be basically a symbolic custodian of Jerusalem, and also that they would guarantee his kingdom is no longer extended to him by Trump. That's why he's freaking out. Because remember, there were three things that Israel had, and they had to choose two out of three in order to be recognized worldwide. The land, being Jewish, being democratic. If they choose being Jewish and democratic, that's a two-state solution. If they choose the land and being democratic, that's a one-state solution. If they want all three, that's apartheid. And of course, the whole world said, we're not going to accept apartheid. That's why they have been warning them to accept a two-state solution. But the current government in Israel, Netanyahu and his friends, said, no, we don't have to choose the three. There is a fourth option. Palestine is Jordan. And that's, you know, they've been saying that for decades, but the U.S. was not supporting this. Now the King of Jordan has no guarantee that this is the case. So he's freaking out that after Jerusalem, that they may push that to be the case, that, you know, his kingdom will vanish. They will give that to the Palestinians and said, okay, you don't need West Bank, you don't need Gaza. Well, you may have Gaza, but it has to be under siege. But that's it. This is Palestine. You can do whatever you want with it. Going back to the Saudi question, so I said, you know, the third thing was to build a security regime, which was, again, based on the U.S. protection and the Gulf Cooperation Council. And he devastated that with his Qatar move. I'm talking about the crown prince. So, and the fourth was that there was a tacit understanding between the regime and the religious scholars, and he started arresting them and changing. So all four pillars that Saudi Arabia was using, the soft power, I'm talking about the fourth one, has been destroyed by this guy. So now they are in a very vulnerable situation.
That's what I would have thought as well. And so the question would be, where would that regime change come from within Saudi Arabia? There are so many different currents opposed to the current system. Many folks have been believing that even with those four pillars intact, they were extremely vulnerable and likely to disappear any time. But in the current situation, I wonder whether that would just spread even more chaos to the region.
Well, Saudi Arabia is obviously a big country, has a lot of wealth, and the people there, they don't have a history of revolting, with the exception, of course, is sometimes people in the East who are Shia. Now, there are a lot of observers who may give you different scenarios of how this might happen. But I think with the current situation, it's probably going to be faster than people thought otherwise. But most likely, whatever change is going to happen, it will have to be a palace coup. It has to be people from the inside. I don't think the population has matured enough to the point where you could have something along the lines of the Arab Spring.
Okay. Well, meanwhile, you're proposing that Muslim countries should be cutting off diplomatic relations with Israel, giving the U.S. 2 weeks, and then starting to withdraw ambassadors and moving towards cutting off relations. Why don't they do that? What is the downside? I understand that if one country tried to do this unilaterally, it might have problems. But if the majority at the OIC were to agree to do that, they and present a reasonably united front, I don't understand what the impediment would be.
That's a good question. That's, you know, that's a challenge we have. And that means that the people have to pressure the governments to, consider Jerusalem what they say it is, which is that it's the central issue of the Ummah, that it is the priority for everybody, and that they need to stand up to the bully. But unless they take concrete actions, it's going to be very difficult. Obviously, every country calculates that they have other interests with the U.S., which I think it's a mistake, because once they give up their biggest issue, nothing else matters. So why are they not, standing up? You can tell. Most of these countries, they don't have the interest of the people or Jerusalem at heart. Most of them would like to keep the protection of the U.S. so that they will not be toppled, that they somehow think that the U.S. guarantees that they will be. Most of these are not democratic countries, with a few exceptions. Now, how is that going to turn out, especially now that they, Turkey and a few other countries will try to turn up, this situation into more of a global struggle, it remains to be seen. But I think the people have to be at the center of this. The more people get involved in this, the more demonstrations, the more they show their anger and outrage and rejection of these unilateral moves, the more we're going to see better results.
Well, in your list of items for actual concrete actions that could be taken by Muslim countries, number 8 is to end all conflicts within the Muslim world, especially in Syria, Yemen, Libya, and elsewhere. Well, that's a great idea. And actually, the Turkish government has moved in that direction in recent years of trying to end conflicts rather than exacerbating them. But it's an easy thing to say, but how can that happen in situations where the conflict seems so entrenched?
That's very true. Again, we're talking about places where, devastation, destruction has taken place for years now, in Syria, Yemen, and Libya in particular. I think it's the realization of the people that these are meaningless conflicts. They don't advance anybody's interest. The people pay the price, and it's the people that they have to demand that these things should end. I think Turkey has moved in that direction, as you said, especially on the Syrian front. And I think the Syrian struggle will soon subside. And I think we're hoping that the same thing will happen in Yemen, although it's not clear to me how that will happen with the way the Saudis have been manipulating the different parties.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me there's an interesting sort of, philosophical, historical backdrop to this, involving the way that unity and disunity kind of interact around Jerusalem al-Quds. That is, when the Muslims first arrived in Jerusalem, it was at a moment when the Byzantine Empire had been riven by conflict and all kinds of strife and factionalism and sectarianism. Christians were persecuting Christians, and they were all persecuting Jews. And then when the Jews got the upper hand, when the Persian Empire made some conquests, Jews massacred, I believe, like over 100,000 Christians. So that these different groups were fighting, and the Byzantine Empire was in this Christian mentality of extreme dogmatism and hatred of people who had slightly different arcane theological beliefs. And then along came Islam with its core principle of Tawhid, or the unit, divine unity, the unity of God, reflected in peace and unity in the world. And that actually led to many of the people in the Byzantine Empire not being particularly enthusiastic, to say the least, about defending the emperor who'd been taxing them horribly, and actually participating in a lot of this factionalism and sectarianism. So it seems that this unity associated with Islam, that is the core principle of Islamic theology, manifested in the world in a certain way, leading to this history of Islamic custodianship of Al-Quds. And it's been interrupted by the Crusades first, and now the Zionist Neo-Crusade, both of which are fanatical, ultra-sectarian, and which violate the core principles of the respective religions, with the Christian Crusades violating the pacifism and unworldliness of Jesus, peace upon him, and the Jewish Zionist Crusade violating the core principle of Judaism, which is that it's God who will bring them back to the Holy Land, not any action by the Jews themselves. So it seems like there's it's kind of interesting historical symbolism playing out here in terms of unity and disunity, and yet it's this disunity in the Islamic world, even though our religion tells us that you know, unity is the core divine principle and we want to manifest it on earth, that you know, we're falling into this same trap.
That's true, but at the end, this is a political struggle. Even though religion is a motivator, especially you know, for those people who are struggling, and they know they have the truth, they know they have justice on their side, and that means God is on the side of justice. God can never be on the side of injustice, on the side of occupation, on the side of brutality, on the side of dispossessing people and murdering them. So, but at the end, this is a pure colonialist settler movement that's trying to displace whole people from its historical land and take it over with absolutely no justification for it. This whole thing about, you know, these biblical things, they really have no justification, neither in history, nor in reality, in politics. They, you know, they could have, I mean, if Jews want to live in their biblical land, the whole land of Islam, as you mentioned earlier, was open to them. When they were kicked out, like Muslims were, from Spain, you know, Islamic Spain, back in the late 1400s and early 1500s, they found the lands of Islam, you know, open to them. They could have gone anywhere. The Sultan at the time, the Ottoman Sultan, opened the whole lands of Islam for them to immigrate. There was no restriction on them where they go and where they land. But when they came with the force of arms, displacing people and taking all their land and trying to impose this racist apartheid-type regime over them, that would not be tolerated and will not be accepted. And Palestinians will not rest, and the rest of the Arabs and the Muslims will not rest until, you know, the whole Zionist project is dismantled.
I mean, so how about the domestic U.S.-American political scene? You were very, very successful as a political organizer. I think, you know, when people write the history of whatever period we're in now, you will be the person who actually was the best at getting a really organized Muslim political coalition going and able to actually have, you know, get that working and get results. Today, we're living through a very strange period here in the U.S. when the unfreedom that followed 9/11 and the 9/11 wars, that when you suffered persecution, this in a way seems like it could get even worse under Trump, with major factional fighting in the background here between the Trump forces and the anti-Trump forces. Do you think that this, you know, the fact that it's Trump who's actually made this move, Trump being a symbol, an embodiment of chaos and strife, and you know, he's the great divider. How could this play out? My sense is that there are a lot of favorable possibilities that, you know, when somebody this unpopular, the most unpopular president at this stage in all of U.S. history, is the one who does this, I can imagine that there could be a backlash that would actually end up being to the advantage of the Palestinians and their supporters.
I believe so, too. You know, I believe that Trump by far is the worst president who's ever been into that office. And I believe that the American people are waking up to the kind of policies that he is trying to impose, but also to the policies that have existed before and they were ignoring it, because somehow people were more interested in domestic rather than foreign policy. But when it comes to Jerusalem, I think they will find that this is an extremely unpopular, it's not unpopular, it's overwhelmingly unpopular throughout the world. You know, look at what happened yesterday. It was 14-1. What happened to the General Assembly today? I mean, it's overwhelmingly being rejected, and they are trying basically to impose that policy and hold the whole American people hostage to the minority, you know, whether they are Zionists or evangelicals. But coming to history, yes, I believe in the system. I believe that the only way we can change U.S. policy was through involvement and engagement, but engagement on the basis of standing to the principles and to your rights and to what is true and just. And in that sense, we made a difference. Incidentally, there was a publication that came 5 years ago in 2012. It's called Encyclopedia of American Dissidents. And it explains to me why I was targeted, because this group of historians put together a list of 152 people that they thought were able to influence American society from 1860 to 2010, over a 150-year period. And in that list of 152 people, they had three people: Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, and to my utter surprise, myself.
That's pretty good company to find yourself in.
Absolutely. It was good company. But also tells me why I was targeted so viciously, you know, by the system in the U.S. They really wanted us to seize this kind of being effective at the highest level, both in Congress and administration. Of course, all that was before 9/11, and to a degree. I don't want to really make it too big, but for the amount of efforts we did, I think we did pretty well.
Yeah, I agree completely. Have you followed any of these cases of Zionist persecutions in recent years? You know, there are some of them that really, you know, leap to mind would be, well, over in Canada, Professor Anthony Hall at the University of Lethbridge has been targeted in a smear campaign that reminds me a little bit of what happened to you, although they haven't arrested him, thank goodness. But they planted a horrific sort of genocidal kill all Jews image on his Facebook page, and then strongly implied in the B'nai B'rith messaging to the media, which the media echoed, that it was him that put that on his own Facebook page, which was absolutely not true. And using this as the public relations springboard, they launched a witch hunt against him, primarily because he's strongly anti-Zionist and has talked about the 9/11 truth movement and the likelihood of Zionist involvement in 9/11. So Tony Hall has been suspended initially without pay, and he finally won his case to the point of getting it back into the university for the university to look at it. But now they're witch hunting him again in the media and in the political system. So it's going to be very difficult for him to even set foot on campus without the fear of violence. So there's one example. There are others. Brendan O'Connell is locked up in New Zealand still seeking political asylum. He spent 3 years in prison in Australia for the crime of arguing impolitely with a Zionist who accosted him and attacked him at a Palestine demonstration. So there are a number of these kinds of cases. Joy Kariga, of course, lost her job as a professor at Oberlin University. So have you followed any of this? Because
I have some, but not all. But I think what the other side is doing is overreaching. And I think after a while, people will start opening their eyes and seeing that these are really all motivated political cases that have no truth to reality, but they are trying to push the envelope. And I think eventually that will catch up with them and people will reject this kind of politics.
Indeed, yeah, that overreaching seems to be characteristic of the Zionists. And sometimes I am really amazed at how much they've managed to get away with, because it's not like they started overreaching just, you know, last year or last decade. It seems like that's basically their identity, is this chutzpah of continually overreaching.
That's true. But on the other hand, if you look at the trend is going against them, even though they think you think that they were at the zenith of their power. Let's think about where the Zionist state was in 1970. They controlled the whole of Palestine. It was pacified, basically. They controlled the Golan Heights, which they still do. They controlled Sinai, which they have to withdraw from. And then by 1982, they had, southern Lebanon up to the Litani River. Within 18 years, they have to withdraw without imposing any settlement whatsoever. A few years later, 20 years later, they had to withdraw in 2005 from Gaza without any conditions, even though it's under siege. So they are contracting. They are not, and now I think even though they have probably the strongest army in the Middle East, but I think the future is with the Palestinians. It's with David, not with Goliath.
A lot of people see that as well, which is one of the reasons I think that there's an upsurge globally in the pro-Palestine movement and the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, which you strongly support. And you're saying that this is a part of the solution to this problem posed by Trump.
Absolutely. I think now is the time for people to take this seriously. And if they really want to see, the conflict will end one way or another. We can end it non-violently by really imposing on Israel all the pressures in the world, because they are so arrogant that they're not going to move without real pressure on them. And the only pressure that would yield results is something akin to the BDS movement, which is a nonviolent movement that is trying to overturn this apartheid regime and give the Palestinians and restore to them their rights. If that's not going to happen, then, what else is left to the victim? So one way or another, this is going to end. And I would rather it ends nonviolently.
Indeed. Well, it's certainly an interesting historical moment. And it's interesting to me that you wound up in Turkey, which is starting to play such a relatively constructive role in all of this. I had hopes for Turkey doing this many years ago. I visited Turkey in 2011. And I was very impressed by what I saw there and the people I met. And then there seemed to be some backsliding as the situation in Syria led to so much chaos and bloodshed that was totally non-productive from a Palestinian point of view. But Turkey is a remarkably, emergent kind of society that has, even though it's sort of colonized in a sense, it's the rump of the Ottoman Empire created by the, Western World War I, and it's very much historically been dominated by Western intervention of various kinds. Operation Gladio killed more people in Turkey than anywhere else. And the military there historically has been subservient to the Western power and the international crime cartels and so on. But it does seem like there's been amazing progress in a real civil society and a real democracy coming slowly but surely into being in Turkey. And so it didn't surprise me that much when Turkey led the way in this OIC meeting in standing up for Palestine. I hope and pray that continues. Are you able to play a fairly active role in the politics of Turkey? I know here in the U.S. you were able to do that for a while, and then look what happened. Turkey is it's democratic, and apparently it's open to a certain amount of activism.
The good thing about Turkey for the past year and a half or so is that they're trying to assert back their will. They want to be independent, really independent, and they want to do what's best for Turkey and the people of the area, not for what's best for the elites or the powerful or the corrupt or what's best for the outsiders. So this is the real story. Basically, in the Middle East right now, we have only three countries who can claim to be independent, and then they, you know, they basically exercise their willpower. Iran, Turkey, and Israel. And everyone else is just subservient to a bigger power. Mm-hmm. So that's what irritates some of these biggest wars against Turkey, against and against Iran, of course, because they challenge this hegemony sometimes. And of course, Israel is exercising whatever willpower it has, because it has this, you know, gripping and overwhelming influence on the biggest country in the world. So that's obviously a different story. But the point I'm trying to make is that this is why Erdogan and Turkey and its policies have been really maligned in the West. I'm not justifying whatever happens here, because obviously every country has challenges, and it tried to meet these challenges with whatever means they have. And if it is right, it's right, and if it's wrong, it's wrong. But at the end of the day, the real problem here is not anything but to exercise your independent power, by which you speak your mind and you challenge the powerful, and not trying to be under their thumb.
Well, that's a good point. And since Turkey and Iran are really the two independent indigenous powers in the Middle East, with Zionist Israel being a settler colony from the West, so we have two countries there, two big and powerful countries that can assert their independence. They have a shared common interest in preserving a Middle East where it's possible to assert independence. In that sense, their common interests, it seems to me, should outweigh any differences. To what extent do you think Turkey and Iran can unite? You know, one can even imagine that one of the best possible scenarios for the Arabian Peninsula would be for a Turkish influence on one side with the holy cities, and an Iranian influence on the other side with the Shia population. I'm not quite sure how that could really happen. But in any case, these are the two countries that have that shared interest in indigenous independence and autonomy. How could they move forward and work together more productively in that area?
I think they're starting to see where their interests align and try to work together. I think there's a lot of still some apprehension and maybe some mistrust. But at least on Syria, they have been working with Russia in order to end this conflict. And that's, I think, a very positive sign. Now, where else can they unite? Where else can they work together? I think in many, many places. I mean, I think they can do that in Yemen. They can do that definitely in Iraq. They did that when they were both threatened with the creation of a Kurdish state that was supported by Israel for the sole purpose of dividing this area. Because if you remember, the audit plan, the strategic plan for Israel is to divide up this area into 30 or 40 countries. And that was part of this plan. So they could, I mean, potentially they could really be a force of good, but they also facing tremendous challenges, because many forces in the region, especially this new alliance that is taking shape with Israel at its heart, is going to try to do everything in its power to disrupt this.
And it's interesting that the motivating factor in much of the region's, you know, anger about what's happening in Al-Quds right now is fundamentally got a religious dimension. And likewise, the Turkey and Iran as independent countries reflect the will of their populations in terms of standing with Palestine, in part because of religious history and Muslim identity. And yet it's also religious history and Muslim identity that can lead to mistrust between these two big independent Middle Eastern powers, based on this notion of you know, Sunni versus Shia, which has, I think, been really accentuated after the Hezbollah victory in 2006. I noticed that before that, you didn't really see that much sort of sectarian propaganda. And then after that, it seemed that suddenly these Gulf networks out of Saudi Arabia and even Al Jazeera became harshly sort of sectarian and anti-Shia. It was as if, you know, somebody was paying money or otherwise buying propaganda to get that kind of thinking going. perhaps as a reaction to Hezbollah's victory. So it is ironic that this religious identity in history is playing these kinds of different and roles that are even at kind of cross purposes.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of sectarianism in the area. I mean, both on both sides, and I think that was to the delight of the people or the powers that are trying to make sure that this area would never be able to stand up again. You know, I remember that the U.S. I met with somebody when I was in the U.S. He was really on the know on what U.S. policy in Syria was. And it was apparent to me, it was clear to me, that the U.S. policy at the time was to make sure that the conflict would not end in Syria. It wasn't really supporting this party over that party. It was supporting that party to make sure it wouldn't give him enough weapons to have victory, but give him enough to keep the fighting going on. And I think Israel had the same policy. You know, it's the same policy that they had in the Iran-Iraq war between 1980 and 88, is to make sure that, you know, people continue to fight. And this is a war of attrition. And that's the way you should have it. Or that's what they think that how that's how their interests would advance. And I think, you know, now people are smarter and they know that fighting each other is not in their interest. It's in the interest of their enemies, and that they need to go beyond this sectarian warfare that has been basically unleashed by either countries which are deeply unpopular because they're trying to keep their monarchies and their power, or by people who are outsiders who want to make sure that they will not be challenged, their influence will not be challenged, which is to the detriment of the people of the area.
Well, I'm certainly no fan of Donald Trump, but it does seem ironic to me that the people, many of the anti-Trump people, have latched on to this charge that Russia manipulated the U.S. election, and Russia is stirring up strife in the United States by, you know, emphasizing the dissident voices and so on. This is the narrative that we're getting from sort of a liberal establishment, and that seems very ironic to me, given that the U.S. has done this sort of thing vastly more brutally and in a much larger scale than anything Russia could even be imagined of being accused of here. We're talking about the way, you know, the U.S. and its allies and its owner, Israel, have managed to stir up all of this strife, amplify the sectarian strife in the Middle East. You've set Iran against Iraq, or rather Iraq against Iran in that war. And yet then when Russia, you know, RT supposedly buys a couple of Facebook ads and covers the presidential election in its own way, that this is a total threat to America. I mean, this really strikes me as ironic and hypocritical.
Well, you know, it is very plausible that Russia, you know, did try or wanted Trump to win, but that's not why he won.
No, they very likely did, and I think they probably do have that
that's
dirty dossier.
That's not why he won. It's not why she lost. I mean, that's
yeah,
wicked.
Yeah, of course.
To think that people went because somehow you had a mass amnesia. No, there were many, and I wrote an article, by the way, about that, and I gave, you know, the different reasons why, and she was deeply unpopular, and a lot of people didn't go to vote. When you go and look at the three states she lost, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, it's very clear why he won and she lost. She did not campaign in these states. A lot of people who voted, especially in Michigan, you can look at even precinct by precinct, how the black people simply didn't show up. She wasn't talking about their interests. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, he lost the popular vote, which tells you by a huge margin, which tells you that we have an archaic system in the U.S. that really does not reflect true democracy. I mean, there are so many reasons that people could do, but, you know, that's not why it's not about Russia manipulating the election, because they did not manipulate anything. They tried, as you said, to use some fake accounts, fake news, you know, this stuff. But that's hardly why he won.
Well, the whole issue of fake news is interesting in this context, because one of the things I always liked about RT and Press TV, these outside of U.S. English language channels, is that they do feature dissident voices that are locked out of the mainstream here. or, you know, occasionally these dissident voices might be brought into the mainstream, as I was in 2006, but that's just to be, you know, beat up on Fox News and used as an illustration of the evils of this or that variety of dissidents. But the foreign channels will bring on voices from the margins, and to my mind, that's good. And in fact, that's actually good for democracy. But we're being told by the elite managers of opinion here that it's the opposite, that this is a subversion of democracy. And it strikes me as a very strange kind of subversion of democracy to be enlarging the spectrum of discussion.
With all due respect, Americans don't listen to foreign news. Al Jazeera paid, Qatar that is, paid $1 billion, with a B, billion dollars, to promote its brand of Al Jazeera. And you have more listeners than Al Jazeera had when they paid that kind of money. You know, when they did the ratings, at their peak, they had 8,000 people. On average, they had 2,000 to 3,000 people watching them a day. You know, you think RT and press and others, they have large constituency? Of course not. And at best, they will have some elites, liberals, you know, dissidents watching them. But that's not American. Americans don't even watch their own news now. You know, they don't even watch, you know, these four networks anymore. I mean, they used to have, what, 22 to 25 million. Now it's down, what, to 6 million. And you know, in 330 million, population of 330 million. I mean, it's a different world today.
Well, you know, I think the elites here are very, very upset and worried about RT, maybe Press TV to a lesser extent. So then one would ask, well, why is that, given that these networks are not reaching huge audiences? And I think the answer is that they may not be reaching the huge audiences directly through satellite. And, of course, Press TV isn't, because it's been banned. The Zionists got them taken down from all of the satellites heading to the West. But I think the problem is that these reports get posted on social media. And so, for instance, when I go on Press TV and debate some crazy Zionist or you know, some crazy Wahhabi or whatever, that sometimes is, it can be fairly interesting, engaging, and entertaining, because it is, you know, vastly more livelier and features a much wider spectrum of views than you would find anywhere else in the English language media. And so people post it on their Facebook page and so on. And just like with the 9/11 truth movement, you know, we didn't succeed in actually awakening the public and, you know, getting a majority of Americans to study the evidence and find out that these buildings were taken down in controlled demolitions. But we got the idea out there. And so everybody knows somebody. Everybody has a family member or a friend who knows this stuff and talks about it. Everybody sees these kinds of reports on their social media channels. And so people are aware of this larger spectrum of views. And then some of the people find that interesting and start looking into it. So I think that they're concerned that there's a potential for a kind of a snowballing of this free thinking. And that's why it's dangerous. Not because people are watching the satellite channels directly, but because the influence reaches them indirectly through social media.
That is true, but to a point, you know, Americans, the American political system really is a system that does not encourage participation. It undermines itself. You know, here in Turkey, just to give you an example, if you reach the age of 18, you're automatically registered. People will, you know, the government would send you your registration card, and on the eve of the election, they will send you a piece of paper to tell you exactly where to go, where to vote, and cast your vote, and it, which is the closest thing that you can do with walking. You know, every school, everywhere is open. I've never seen something like this. And I lived in the United States for 40 years, watched many elections. People would be standing, you know, especially in presidential elections, you know, for hours. Here, you'll come in and out in 3 minutes. And they have a participation rate last time of 87%. And this is a country of almost 80, 85 million people. So, but here, you know, over there in the U.S., people, you know, the elites, that is, political parties, they have not been encouraging real participation. They have, you know, it's just window dressing. If you really want people to state their opinion and have real democracy, forget about Russia, forget about Iran. They will never manipulate the United States. But allow people to actually vote. You know, give them their voting cards once they turn the age of 18. Make it easy for them to vote. What is this thing about Tuesday? Why Tuesdays? When people, the poor people, they can barely make it. You want them to miss work. doesn't work like this. This whole system was designed so that only part of the people would vote. You know, at best we get what, 50-60%. That's when you really have, you know, like a Kennedy Nixon type election, when you get that kind of turnout.
Well, I would propose that we move here in the U.S. to a Judeo-Christian Islamic weekend and declare Friday a holiday, as well as Saturday and Sunday. And then we could have elections on Friday. That way the Christians wouldn't be forced to vote on Sunday if they don't believe in that. And the Jews wouldn't have to vote on Saturday because they have a prohibition on that sort of thing. And we Muslims wouldn't, I don't think we would have a problem voting on Friday. So there you would solve two problems, two birds with one stone.
We don't need really a three-day weekend. I mean, as Muslims, I have no problem working on Friday as long as I have my freedom to go and pray and come back. So that you need to give that flexibility, by law, that they will not be losing anything to take a two-hour break to go and pray somewhere. So it's okay. I mean, by the way, Turkey, to your amazement, is a Muslim country, but their weekend Saturday, Sunday. So people here work on Fridays when it's time to prayer. You can hardly find a place or a mosque, which, by the way, Turkey has the largest number of mosques anywhere in the Muslim world. In Istanbul here alone, there is about 3,800. And every mosque is full, absolutely full. You can't find a place to sit. So you can work it out. But in terms of when to, I don't think Christians would have a problem to vote on Sunday. And I think most Jewish Americans don't even practice the Sabbath. So what you could do is you can allow 3-day elections. Why does it have to be one day?
There you go. It's a good idea. It's a great idea. When I proposed this 3-day Judeo-Christian Islamic weekend, I'm half facetious, because in fact, the real reason for doing it is not so much to equally honor the three monotheisms, although that's always well and good, but really because we have too long of a work week. The work week shrunk from 80 plus hours in the mid-19th century down to 40 hours in 1930. And since then, it's been going in the wrong direction, even as unemployment has grown and useful employment abilities, rather opportunities, have shrunk due to automation and increased productivity. So we've been having a more and more unequal society as we work harder and harder for less and less reason. And I think taking an extra day off and then getting used to the idea of using leisure time usefully, such as by, for instance, learning about how the country works and then being able to participate in voting and help run it. All of this would be a useful project. So I'm for a 3-day weekend, and this is just a way of packaging it.
Right. But I think U.S. politics will not materially change until we break the two-party system.
Yes.
Until we have that, it's not going to be. And both parties right now, they are reinforcing each other. So they don't really talk about the real issues when people, it's really always at the superficial level. I remember back, when George Senior, George H.W. Bush was president, and, he was proposing a defense budget. And the Democrats came, had some kind of a press conference, and I was really intrigued to see, what the fuss was about. He was proposing $290 billion budget, and they were proposing $289. That was the fuss, $1 billion. So it's not, there is no real fundamental challenge to the dominant narrative. It's really a multinational mentality that is controlling. But, in social issues, one liberal, one conservative. But all others, it's really very superficially presented. And that's, but the real differences, when you talk about real parties with fundamental differences, they have been shut out of the political system. And until that changes, it's going to stay the same and people will be apathetic.
Yes, I agree. I think there's a chance of a third party emerging here. What we saw happen with Trump this year, with this sort of weirdly obnoxious, macho, charismatic guy posing as a populist and riling up ordinary people who are upset about increasing inequality, the loss of jobs for working class people, and so on. Well, Trump exploited that by blaming scapegoats. It's the Mexicans, it's the Muslims, et cetera, et cetera. But and that worked for him. But, you know, I could imagine something like that happening with a better populist, somebody like Jesse Ventura, who nearly ran for president in 2008 and might have actually had a chance, despite his rather radical views on certain topics, including 9/11. So we could conceivably have a real populist do what the fake populist Trump did. Trump showed us that there's room for a populist who's beat up by the media, and still that ends up just reinforcing his credentials because nobody really believes the media anymore. So I could imagine something coming along and breaking this logjam. I'm not sure who is likely to do it, though.
Well, I predicted, you know, a few years ago that once the Hispanics become significant demographically in Texas, once Texas flips from Republican to a Democrat, that's a flip of 70 electoral votes because it goes from one column to the other. That will make Republicans really in the minority when it comes to presidential elections. And that would help, you know, those who are truly conservative from those who are business type Republicans will split them. And once that happens, the Democrats would feel free also to split into two. So the business Democrats and the business Republicans will form a new majority party. And then the truly liberals and leftists will have their own significant party, and the truly conservative and crazies will have their own party. So we may end up with a three-party system, which is the best thing that could ever happen to America, because then you can have real coalitions and real compromises, because you may not actually have a majority at one point or another. But that's probably maybe the key away. And I think what's happening with Trump is that he accelerated this theory, this thing. And I think a lot of people are totally disenchanted, and some are even mobilized by the fact that we may get someone like this who may destroy the whole country, so we better get involved.
Okay, well, that's a good place to end it, and I appreciate the way you've gotten involved. It's great to hear that people are so involved in Turkey, that democracy is on the rise in that country that has a history of dictatorships and coups d'etat. It was great to see the people of Turkey rejecting the attempted coup d'etat a couple of years ago and now voting in such high percentages. Maybe someday we can get back to that level of interest and participation here in the U.S., inshallah. And someday we may also be able to liberate Jerusalem, the original topic of our discussion, inshallah. But we're at the end of the hour today, so I want to thank you, Dr. Samuel Aryan. You're the director of the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zion University, and one of our true American heroes as well. So keep up the great work. I look forward to another conversation down the line.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Likewise. Take care. Bye-bye.